Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, August 14, 2019. South Sudan's parties are scheduled to meet in Addis Ababa to discuss the status of the 2018 peace deal.
It needs political will on the parties. It needs resources. And it is a huge operation. People are working on it. It may not be completed within the next 3 months, but it is something we are committed, especially as a party, as SPLM-IO. In fact, I believe we are ahead of the government.
And President Salva Kiir meets with a Darfur rebel leader in Juba.
This social malaise may destroy the social fabric of our society. And if we let it go, if we do not give it a priority and treat it as an experiment on it, we are in crisis. But this one is...
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. IGAD's Council of Ministers say the parties to the South Sudan's revitalized peace deal have done little to implement the critical security arrangement ahead of the formation of a transitional government of national unity in November. The regional bloc is convening a meeting for all parties to the agreement in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia next week. Dimo Silva Aurelio reports for VOA from Juba.
In a letter signed by Gedo Andagachiu, chairperson of the IGAD Council of Ministers sent to all signatories of the revitalized peace agreement, IGAD asked the parties to meet in the Ethiopian capital on August 21st. Stephen Parkwall, SPLM-IO's Secretary for Foreign Relations, says his party will use the talks to update IGAD about the status of security arrangements.
I think the Council of Ministers of IGAD will discuss with us, and it will not just start with discussions. I think they need to be updated with the steps we have taken so far with the implementation of agreements, particularly in the security arrangements and IBC consensus that has been reached by the members of the IBC.
Par says the next meeting will be critical given the issues like the cantoning of forces and number of states are still unresolved with the November deadline fast approaching.
It needs political will on the parties, it needs resources, and it is a huge operation. People are working on it. It may not be completed within the next 3 months, but it is something we are committed, especially as a party, as SPLM-IO. In fact, I believe we are ahead of the government in the preparation for these arrangements of transitional security.
Government spokesman Michael McQuay says the government of South Sudan will send representatives to the Addis meeting.
It's a consultative meeting on the agreement. They want to go and they want to get brief, and then they know what is our way forward.
In its latest report released last week, the South Sudan ceasefire monitoring body, Citizens, say the parties to the agreement have not respected a call by the Joint Defence Board for all SPLM-IO and government forces to report to their cantonment sites and barracks. Both sides have repeatedly complained about a lack of funds to implement security arrangements. Shortly after the parties extended the pre-transitional period for another 6 months, the Kiir administration pledged $100 million to carry out security arrangements, but the government has so far released only $10 million of the $100. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
To understand the difficulties the peace agreement is facing in South Sudan, we go live to Ali Vaji, a senior advisor at the U.S. Institute of Peace and a fellow of the Rift Valley Institute. He was also the deputy and then acting chief of staff to the former chairman of the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, a body overseeing the 2015 peace agreement in South Sudan. Ali Vaji, welcome to this show.
Thank you, John.
Tell us, what is wrong with the revitalized peace deal? Why is it facing difficulties?
Well, the timeline for the agreement is something you can easily write on paper, but finding the will and the efforts to make it happen on time has always been missing. And one of the problems of the 2018 agreement is that it almost treated the 3 years from the 2015 agreement as if they hadn't happened. And so many of the provisions have some minor modification, but are basically the same. And of course, the situation in terms of the conflict has evolved, but the desires of the parties to actually bring a sustainable and lasting peace is still in question.
And let's talk about that, the desires of the parties. And here we are hearing from the representative of the SPLM-IO who just spoke in the piece that was aired. He was saying that there's a question of a political will. Yeah. If indeed there's a problem with the political will, why did they sign the agreement? I mean, would you tell us why these parties actually signed the agreement in the first place?
Well, I think only they can speak to their motivations, but this idea of political will is not something that comes from the outside. It's something that's intrinsic to the parties. And if they wanted to move forward with many of the provisions, then they could have done so. And that's not only the IO, that's the other parties in the opposition, that's the government as well. Let's look at the government, for example. What is there today is still supposed to be a transitional government. But it doesn't act like a transitional government. It acts like one that proceeds with the normal affairs of state and this involvement in the Darfur talks and what have you. There isn't urgency. You don't see the urgency from anyone to move forward. And that is what political will ultimately is about.
And with this in the backdrop, what is the way forward? Because it looks like the future is a little bit bleak when we talk about November 12th deadline.
Well, you will remember, John, that people had similar conversations with the original deadline before it was extended, and ultimately nothing terrible happened. One of the differences now compared to before is that basically the people in power can just more or less carry on. If there's a further delay or a further adjustment to the timeline, does that really change their position or their situation? I don't think it does. The opposition, for the most part, doesn't have the leverage to force progress forward. So I think it's quite possible that there's a further delay. You can see that the mere fact of having this meeting in Addis Ababa to update the regional guarantors and other stakeholders to the process tells you that the mechanisms for the agreement aren't working. They should already be very much aware of what's going on and have their representatives in Juba tell them what's happening. They don't necessarily need to have a meeting just to hear this is what's happened, this is what hasn't happened. So I think we're in for a continued period where not a whole lot will happen, and whether there'll be another extension, I wouldn't bet against it.
And Ali, I've been listening to the various leaders of the parties to this agreement. If you listen to the government will say, well, we need help so that we can finance the establishment of the cantonment. If you listen to the rebels will blame the government for not giving the money for establishment of the cantonment. Now, this, to our listeners, sounds like a blame game. Is this tactics of negotiation?
Well, there certainly is a need for resources. I don't think anybody can deny that. But let's also look at it a bit more critically. So we've just heard in your report that most of the money that was pledged hasn't been delivered. But have we ever heard the government say, okay, we will match dollar for dollar or pound for pound the resources that come in from the outside? Yes, we need external support, but we also want the internationals to support us, and we're going to demonstrate our commitment by matching that money. For example, some things don't cost a lot of money. They don't require resources to pass a law or enact constitutional amendments or many of the other provisions that could demonstrate a commitment and a serious effort towards implementation. So when people talk about resources, it's certainly true to one extent, but it's not the full story.
Well, Ali Vaji, thank you very much for your time speaking to us on this important matter.
Thank you, John.
That was Ali Vaji, a senior advisor at the U.S. Institute of Peace and a fellow at the Rift Valley Institute. He was also the deputy and then acting chief of staff to the former chairman of the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission. One of the leading Sudanese rebel groups operating in Darfur, the Justice and Equality Movement, says it will join the peace mediation efforts with Sudan's military leaders. GEM's leader, who arrived in Juba yesterday upon an invitation from President Salva Kiir, emerged from talks with the president to say he looks forward to more talks with the Sudan Transitional Military Council led by Juba. Wake Simon Wudu has more for VOA from Juba.
After nearly 2 hours of talks with President Salva Kiir and Kiir's security advisor Tutu Galwak at the State House, GEM leader Jibril Mohamed Ibrahim told the reporters in Arabic that President Kiir invited all armed groups to Juba shortly after he met with Sudan's Transitional Military Council to try and end the political standoff between military and opposition leaders in Sudan.
Following the consultation, the first problem was then the killings which happened in Sudan. President wanted to have a good conversation with the Sudan armed groups in Juba so that we can reach a solution that can bring peace to Sudan, because stability in Sudan is stability in South Sudan.
Ibrahim characterized his meeting with President Kiir as fruitful, adding the meeting focused on consultations with the GEM movement on how his group and other armed groups in Sudan can discuss their differences with the Transitional Military Council to end instability in Sudan. While Ibrahim and Galwak did not take questions from the media, Ibrahim says GEM is committed to holding talks with Sudan's military council under the mediation of President Kiir.
We have assured the government of South Sudan of our commitment to bring peace and stability in Sudan, because South Sudan has a role to play in addressing issues in Sudan, and that is why stability of Sudan is stability of South Sudan. We have assured our stand with the South Sudan.
Last month, President Kiir held meetings at the State House OJ1 with Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, the deputy chairman of the Sudan Transitional Military Council, and Sudanese armed groups such as the Sudan People's Liberation Movement North factions led by Malik Agar and Abdul Aziz Al Hilo. Ibrahim did not take part in those meetings.
We urge them to organize for more of such dialogues in the future with the other groups in Sudan, which we think the advisor on security will do in the coming days. We will be having dialogue with the president and the groups in Sudan, and the main important thing is peace.
Galwak says he expects President Kiir to host Sudan's armed groups at a joint meeting in Juba, which he says will likely take place sometime next week. He says the meetings will be aimed at ending instability between the two groups inside South Sudan's neighbor to the north. Kiir had earlier offered to mediate disputes between the various Sudanese armed groups and the Sudanese government following accusations and counter-accusations by both countries' leaders about harboring each other's militias. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
Members of South Sudan's National Dialect Steering Committee are calling on the Interior Minister to crack down on gangs like one calling themselves the Toronto Boys, who often ride on motorcycles and snatch bags of pedestrians on the streets of Juba. Some profanities uttered by people interviewed in this story have been omitted. Lasuba Memo has more for VOA from Juba.
Juba resident Grace Kiden says she was walking along a street in Munukipayam when a group of youth she suspects were members of the Toronto Boys came roaring up from behind, grabbed her purse and sped off. She says her bag had $200 in it.
They just came in a group and then confused me around. One of them came at a speed and then snatched my... All the money was gone. I was left. And then with my phone, I was left with nothing. So I felt so desperate, so helpless, because what I came with was in the purse and then the phone.
He's speaking in Arabic. Denis Okenye, who sells bread on the streets of Juba, says such robberies are common in the capital.
I often witness the Toronto robbing people here on this street every morning. One day, they robbed a Somali here.
Concerned about the escalating number of robberies by motorcycle riding bandits, members of the National Dialogue Steering Committee summoned Interior Minister Michael Chenjek today to explain what he is doing to reduce the daytime robberies. Agnes Joseph, a member of the National Dialogue Steering Committee, says she suggested the panel question Minister Chenjek because there has been a steep uptick in motorbike robberies across the country.
Because the are all over the country, it's not alone. The is going with Toronto. They are working together. So it was an issue that affecting all over South Sudan.
Chenjek acknowledges that more and more outlawed groups of teenagers on motorbikes are robbing people in the streets of South Sudan, but says it's not easy for authorities to catch the criminals. He says even when they are arrested, the suspects are underage and often go free in Juba's juvenile court.
The group, mainly the group that robbed, these are the ones harassing nasty markets, especially the ladies. They have descriptions that sometimes we arrested them.
After hearing from the minister, members of the steering committee suggested the government establish reformatories to confine juveniles involved in criminal acts. Joshua Dao Diu is a member of the National Dialogue Steering Committee.
These social measures may destroy the social fabric of our society. And if we let it go, if we do not give it a priority and treat it as an experiment on it, we are in crisis. But this one is serious than the crisis we are now facing. What we may ask immediate and strong coordination between the Minister of Social Welfare and Gender and the Minister of Interior, plus relevant civil society that also care and know how to handle this issue.
Diu warns that if this trend continues, more children will get involved in what he calls hooligan practices and drop out of school due to peer influences. For VOA News, I am Lasuba Memo in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, a former refugee is back to Kakuma Refugee Camp to help other refugees with computer programming. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what do you love about Africa?
It's about the nature and the green about it, and then the hospitality it has.
Africa's got tremendous mountains, rivers, lakes, animals. The beauty of Africa itself, inviting Europeans, Australians, Asians to come and visit Africa.
I love the hair. I love the thinking. I love the brain. I love the people. I love the lands of Africa. And I love the history of Africa.
It's nature, it's beauty, weather. All is good. And the way that it favors a human being and even the growing of crops, that's food.
When I look at Africa, I most like the natural beauty of Africa. All the seas, rivers. So I'm proud to be in Africa.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011 and we'll get back to you. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
And now to our story about a remarkable African woman who was able to turn her life around after being abused for years. Mariame Jame was trafficked from Senegal to France at the age of 13 to work as a prostitute. Later, she lived in a refugee center before making her way to Britain, where she became interested in computer programming. She has made it her mission to teach 1 million women and girls, including refugees, how to program by 2013. Ruud Elmendrop reports from the Kakuma refugee camp in Kenya.
Psychologists, we know psychotherapists. We are business people.
We're in a classroom in Kenya's Kakuma refugee camp. Students look at Senegalese technologist Mariam Jam. She's dressed in a colorful African dress and is giving the students a lesson.
So I want you to just recap what we've learned.
She's also telling the students about her I Am the Code movement, which aims to teach 1 million women and girls, including refugees, how to program computers by 2030.
Mentees and mentors, you and I.
Mariam Jam was brought to the Kakuma refugee camp through the Young Global Leaders program of the World Economic Forum. She's here to teach and inspire others to overcome hardship, as she did.
And at 13 years old, I was taken away from my country, Senegal, to France. So I really suffered as a young girl growing up in a suite of France as a young prostitute. And at the age of 16, I was picked up by the French police under the tube station and sent to a refuge center where I grew up. And then I ended up in the UK when I was 18.
In Britain, Jam, driven by a love for math and science, taught herself computer programming. She's now the CEO of a business consultancy firm and has advised organizations such as Google, Ernst & Young, Microsoft and UN Women, in addition to many African governments. Now she wants to help other girl refugees learn 21st century skills and escape lives of poverty.
And so I really understand what the refugee girls are going through, dreaming, not having enough, suffering from loss and pain and difficulties. I understand where they're coming from. And that's why always people ask me, where is this passion coming from? It's coming from there because I understand them. I've been there as a child like them.
Elizabeth Adith is a refugee from South Sudan who's benefiting from the program.
I am the code. Will really help me because it will equip me with skills that will help me to compete with other communities and other counties because it will give me skills in technology. So that is really very helpful.
There's still a long way to go to reach Jam's goal to teach 1 million women and girls. But since 2011, I Am the Code has trained thousands of women and girls. And that's something to celebrate, especially in a refugee camp. Ruud Elmendrop for VOA News, Kakuma, Kenya.
UNICEF has renewed its call for African governments to ensure that births of all children are registered and that formal birth certificates are provided to their families. This helps ensure that those children will be officially included in society and benefit from government health care, school enrollment, and future employment opportunities. Today, only half of sub-Saharan African children are registered. If that trend continues, there will be 115 million unregistered children by 2030. To find out more about the importance of birth registrations and certificates, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with James Elder, UNICEF's communication chief for Eastern and Southern Africa.
For so many parts of the world, a birth certificate is simply a nice piece of paper that we keep in a drawer. But what a birth certificate is that membership card for society that basically opens doors to health and education and protection. Without that, these children, before they can even walk and talk, are already excluded, already risk being on the margins, already risk vulnerability, whether it's early marriage or child labour or trafficking and illegal adoption networks, which are on the rise. So that's the scope of the problem. The good news is that we've seen that when you link registering at birth with a health centre, you can double birth registration rates. And we've seen that. Uganda, Namibia, Ghana, Mali, Ethiopia, they have doubled them. So don't let a mother have to come back and leave other children and carry a child to go through that bureaucracy. Do it at the point of birth and the numbers change dramatically.
But a large number of African women still give birth at home, far away from a birth center or hospital.
Yeah, a lot of people still don't give birth in health centres, but increasingly across sub-Saharan Africa, we are getting mobile health clinics, we're getting outreach from community workers, so we are more and more getting trained medical staff with those mums at the time of delivery. And if that's the case, we can also get them a birth certificate. Now, of course, if mothers aren't giving birth with any health staff or near any health centre, of course, it's a health problem and it's going to be difficult to get them a birth certificate. It's also important to remember that we're not just talking about birth certificates so that children can access quality education or access healthcare or, of course, have greater safety. Birth certificates are also really critical because they give the government the ability to count how many kids they've got. And if a government doesn't know how many children there are, then they can't possibly budget around healthcare and education. And it has ramifications from a child's life all the way through schooling, through their chance to get a job. So it's very much a case of being right in practice, but right in principle as well.
Birth certificates have always been important, of course, but it seems that UNICEF is stressing the urgency of birth registrations now in today's Africa. Why?
Right now, Africa is experiencing this population shift that's essentially unprecedented in its scale and size and swiftness in human history. You know, we're looking in the next few decades, about 1.8 billion babies being born in Africa. Now, that means we've got to get the basics right. Let's get these children a birth certificate and then move through to quality education and healthcare. Then we know that as young adults, we give them a much better chance of being productively employed. And we know when that happens, this is Africa's great chance for increased production, for increased savings, and to get this economic boom that could finally drastically reduce poverty. This is not a once-in-a-lifetime chance. This is a once-in-a-100-year chance. And again, we're talking sub-Saharan Africa where 3 in 4 people are still under $2 a day. And if you don't give them birth certificates, if you don't give them quality education, if you leave them on the margins of society, then you've got tens of millions of unemployed young people with all the flow-on effects of stability, security, unemployment, deprivation. So it's the moment for the continent right now and in the coming few years. And the beauty of it is it's not so difficult as long as these systems are brought together. If there wasn't something simple, we would have an even bigger problem.
That was James Elder, spokesperson for UNICEF in Eastern Southern Africa. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202-630-8011 and we'll get back to you. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202-630-8011.
And the number is +1 202-630-8011. That's our show for this Wednesday. We'll now leave you with the song Particular by Meja.
Go down.
Yeah, yeah.
Fire down.
They told me everybody's 15 minutes in a different time zone. And since I have it at the moment, you don't wanna shine my light on. Get your life, little mama, won't you get your life on? Ain't nothing cooler than the wrong moves when you do them to the right song, the right song. Let's shoot this movie and put the shit on repeat. I hope this memories I'm making you fall asleep. Before we hit the road, put our phones on silent. Nobody's trying to bring peace. What would it take to change the plans for the weekend? Cause I'm trying to kick it like eating. The whole thing, the pre-party, the pre-sex. Then we hit the major league with a Jesus.
Hey, I like you down in particular. You in particular. See, I like your waist in particular. I like your waist in particular. Give me love one of these days, yeah. I knew the first time I saw you there, yeah. Give me love one of these days, ha, ha. Got it, go. Now you stop it, mommy, you already know, mama. Got it, yeah, we got it, go. Me, I can't lie, oh. I like you, girl, in particular.
We've been listening to Meja with the song Particular. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for joining us. Please tune in again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
I like you girl in particular. You in particular. I like your waist in particular. Particular, yeah. You in particular, yeah. I like your waist in particular.